Then the Lord said to me, "You have made your way around this hill country long enough. Now turn north. Give the people these orders. You are about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. The Lord your God has blessed you in all the works of your hands. He has watched over your journey through this vast desert. These 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked anything." So we went on past our brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. We turned from the Arabah road, which comes up from Elath and Ezion-Geber, and traveled along the desert road of Moab. Then the Lord said to me, "Do not harass the Moabites to provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession." Now, when the last of these fighting men among the people had died, the Lord said to me, "Today you are to pass by the region of Moab at Ar. When you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites. I have given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot. Set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I have given into your hand Sihon, the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you in all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you. From the desert of Kedemoth, I sent messengers to Sihon, king of Heshbon, offering peace and saying, 'Let us pass through your country. We will stay on the main road. We will not turn aside to the right or to the left. Sell us food to eat and water to drink for their price in silver. Only let us pass through on foot, as the descendants of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for us, until we cross the Jordan into the land the Lord our God is giving us.' But Sihon, king of Heshbon, refused to let us pass through. For the Lord your God had made his spirit stubborn and his heart obstinate in order to give him into your hands as he has done now. The Lord said to me, 'See, I have begun to deliver Sihon and his country over to you. Now begin to conquer and possess his land.' When Sihon and all his army came out to meet us in battle at Jahaz, the Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down, together with his sons and his whole army. Next we turned and went up along the road toward Bashan, and Og, king of Bashan, with his whole army marched out to meet us in battle at Edrei. The Lord said to me, 'Do not be afraid of him, for I have handed him over to you with his whole army and his land. Do to him what you did to Sihon, king of Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon.' So the Lord our God also gave into our hands Og, king of Bashan, and all his army. We struck them down, leaving no survivors. At that time we took all his cities. There was not one of the 60 cities that we did not take from them, the whole region of Argob, Og's kingdom in Bashan. Only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Raphaites, who made his bed. His bed was made of iron and was more than 13 feet long and 6 feet wide. It is still in Rabbah of the Amorites. This is the word of the Lord.
when they're not doing setup, my two sons are about making these little clay figures, and they bake them in the oven, and they sculpt them, bake them in the oven, come out and they paint them. And the other day, Thaddeus came into my room. He was very excited. He said, look at this figure I made. I just finished it. I took a look at it, and I said, Thaddeus, this looks to me like it's a monk with a bazooka. He said, yes, that's right. I got the robe there, and he had the bazooka over his shoulder, and I said, it's a monk with a bazooka. He said, yeah, isn't it great? Didn't it come out really well? I said, well, there seems to be no, you know, comprehension of the duality here at all. He said, yeah, it's that's it. And I said, but it's a monk with a bazooka. And he said, that's it. It was great. So I said, well, it's well done. And he went out, and I was puzzled by it, but there was something else that happened after that made it all make sense, sort of. He gave it to Scott Grider. Then I started thinking, Scott Grider, a monk with a bazooka. Both speak of forceful holiness. Both have a desire for sanctification that can get violent. This suddenly made sense to me. Now, it took something for it all to make sense to me. Really, we're looking at a story today, and we took selections here to give you a sweep of what was going on here that can jar us. And in light of current sensibilities, in light of current events, may seem like it creates a dualism between a loving God and the hell of a war that he nonetheless commands to happen. And it was because, I posit to you, that just as I needed to understand more of Thaddeus' purposes, we need to understand something of God's purposes to make it make sense to us. And I want you to know that at this moment, I am still glad that we are going through a tour of Deuteronomy. I am still glad about it. I am dedicated to preaching the whole counsel of God to this church. Maybe we don't hear about this too often, but this is Bible, folks. And I am not going to send you into the Old Testament and ask you to believe it like I have been doing without at least equipping you to understand the questions that it raises. So I'm going to try to do that today. What I'm going to try to do is show you that there is not a contradiction between the God that many of you have come to know and the purposes he has always had for the earth. And further, I want you to see why it is important for us to know this, to know this part of God, to understand this about him. And I'm not content just simply to explain it, to explain to you why it's important. Now, those are two tall orders, so you'll have to allow me some incompleteness here. If I don't tie up every string here, it's quite possible I won't, because we in the Christian church are so uneducated in the Bible. This serves as only an introduction to a large topic that we largely ignore to our detriment, I think. But if you have questions and objections, we have a time downstairs in the far room where you can come and ask those and express them. But the more I look at it, folks, the more I'm convinced that it's necessary for us to understand our lives as urban Christians. Understand first this one thing, that Jesus Christ died and rose again in order to conquer the world. I know that you don't think of his death and resurrection in those terms often. You think of it in more personal terms for yourself. But you have to understand the way the New Testament presents it to us. He died and rose again to conquer the world. He intends his conquest of the world to be absolute, no ifs, ands, and buts. Before he left, he told his disciples, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That's just one example that he needs to take over the whole world. And you cannot have a Christianity that does not intend that Christ will win over the world. King of kings, Lord of lords, what do you think that means? You cannot have a Jesus Christ who does not say that his kingdom will fill the whole earth and replace every human regime eventually. Now, you might try, as Thomas Jefferson did, to take a scissors and cut out offensive statements that you don't like that Christ made. Jefferson was offended by references, you remember, to the supernatural. So he took scissors and paste to the New Testament. I saw this once down in Washington. And he took the view that all references to miracles were a later accretion to Christ's real life and work. And you can look at the result. You can read the result that he came up with. And it's just silly, folks. There are many events suddenly no longer make sense. Many words suddenly no longer make sense. The same is true if you try to cut out Christ's expressions of his dominion and how they're going to be all extensive over the whole world. You're left with a gospel that doesn't make sense. So that is not only the intention of Christ, that's a promise of Christ. He claims that you will see him coming in the clouds of heaven. That means he will have final victory over the whole earth. He will reign here. And I'll tell you, no salvation worth its salt could promise less. He won't just crush some of the evil we see around us in people, some of the earth. He's taking it all. But you need to know this, too, when I say that it's not ethnic or national nor even military conquest that's in Christ's view. How he is carrying out his conquest is different from anything you expect. How he conquers makes all the difference. Why he conquers makes all the difference. So let's go to this passage, and I have to tell you a story. It's really part of a larger story. Listen to this grand and sweeping tale, which brings us to today's passage, and then to our tales today. Many years before the events of this passage, what Rana just read, many years before the events of this passage, a god brought a man to the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, and he told him, I am going to give you this region as a way of building my people on earth. And from you and your resulting community, all other peoples are going to be helped. Because this will be the center from which the message of my salvation will go out to the whole earth. And I will even make your people a nation, a kingdom, in order to be the hub of blessing for other kingdoms. And I need to tell you this, the God went on, that there are people in this land that need to either be incorporated or thrown out because they won't like what I'm doing. Most of them won't. But, this God told this man, there's only one problem. The people here are not so bad yet. So I don't feel it's right now to justify the inevitable bloodshed that will come. So I'm going to send you and your progeny down to Egypt for 400 years and let the people here get worse and worse until the inevitable carnage that will come of trying to set up the kingdom of God on this rebellious earth will be completely justified. The man's name was Abraham. The God's name was Yahweh. The time was sometime in the Middle Bronze Age, perhaps early 2nd millennium B.C., long ago. And in the book that we are now touring, Deuteronomy, chapter 9, this same God now asserts that he's ready to conquer this land, the land of Canaan. But he repeats, and he says over and over, if you read through chapter 9, the context of this book, it was not because Israel was better or stronger or morally great, really. It's that the nations were to be driven out of the land because of the resident nation's wickedness. It's the wickedness of the peoples in the land that made it right for God's kingdom. And folks, it was terrible. This is something that Anita Diamond got wrong in The Red Tent, if you read that. The religions that somehow the religions of Canaan were life-affirming. But the religion of the cult of Yahweh was repressive. Not so. The Canaanites, they wouldn't just take the elderly out and leave them exposed because being elderly wasn't cool. They would habitually sacrifice their children for good climate. So we are talking here about a war to establish a community for God's salvation to be brought to earth. And so it was called Holy War, because it wasn't for the sake of national conquest, but carried out for the purpose of his bringing about his kingdom on earth in strict adherence to guidelines God gave. So it's essential for us to pay attention to how this holy war, as it's called, is conducted. We cannot go through the whole book of Joshua to see it, but here it begins. And what Moses does here is give us four stories, four tales that form a progression showing the range of reactions and actions that took place as the Israelites advanced on Canaan. And we took selections from these two chapters to try to give you a picture on the scale of these chapters of the progression that the author is trying to make, is trying to get across. If we just look at the end of the passage, we read about King Og's bed. Probably not bed, probably a sarcophagus, I mean, literally resting place. And it was 13 feet by 6 feet. You know, the point is, the king was big. The resistance to God's program was strong. But that didn't matter. It didn't matter what the obstacles were going to be, because God was building his kingdom. So these victories for Israel were a sign to them of what was going to come when they crossed the Jordan, what they were about to do. It's an introduction. The four tales are a foretaste of the Holy War. And let me tell you, this is different from any war that was ever conducted. It's just, I want to go through them quickly, what these four tales, just go over them with you. First tale, right? Passage through the land of the Edomites. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. The moral here was, go out of your way not to fight. No matter what, don't fight them. Don't take their land. Be very careful not to fight. And there's a parallel here in Numbers 20. If you read this story in Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21, you find that story filled out. And it gets very tense. Moses sends to them and says, we've recently been slaves in Egypt. No need to fear us. We are just going to pass through. Edomites send back and say, no. Moses says, sends to them and says, look, we're going to stay on the main road, on the king's highway, running to the top there of the Dead Sea. We're not even going to turn off of it. And we're going to pay you in silver for anything we eat, anything our animals eat. It'll be good for your economy. Edomites say, no. And not only did they say no, they came out with an army to fight. So what did Israel do? The takers of the promised land. The people who needed to establish a reputation here that they were unstoppable. They turned around and went away and went around. No bravado, nothing. They just ran away. It was God's will. And, you know, there was nothing really special. If you read it just in this text, you might get misimpressed. There's nothing really special about the descendants of Esau, except that they weren't that bad at this point. They weren't specially chosen by God. In fact, God would say by a later prophet that Esau he hated. Later on in Deuteronomy, they get lumped with the Egyptians. But here, God speaks to them in a way to preserve the Edomites. Since they weren't so bad, he tries to draw connections for Israel, try to emphasize similarities to support this policy of non-aggression. He says, look, they were born of Isaac, just like you. And he says, in verse 7, you haven't lacked anything, because water was scarce in eastern Edom and closely guarded. So if they were going to be forbidden to enter the land, to cross through, God wanted them reassured that on the desert road, that they were going to have to take instead, he would still take care of them. Okay, that's the first story. If there's a conflict, in this case, turn around, run away. Don't you dare harm these people. Second story, passage through the land of Moabites, chapter 2, verses 9 through 23. Again, don't touch, though the command is not as strongly put or as strongly tested. Seek peaceful passage through this land. And again, God tries to draw connections for them. Remember Lot. Not that these people were all that great, really, either. Began disreputably through incest. The Israelites knew all this, but God tried to draw a connection for them. Third story, crossing the Arnon Gorge and meeting the Amorites. Now, this land turned out to be different. It ends up, the story, being about the defeat of Sihon, king of the Amorites, at Heshbon. And I want you to know that what we find Israel doing is first making a peace offer, and then, in the face of stubbornness, going to war. In Hebrew, baderach, baderach, they say. On the highway, on the highway. We're really not going to go off the highway. We're staying on the road, they say to him. And please note that this spotless peace that they make is after God says, go take it. Okay, verse 27 happens after verse 24. How can that be? Were they being disobedient? No. No. If you read between the lines, you can see here the contours of this holy war. How they had been previously instructed to proceed by God. And it is to make absolutely sure that these people won't cooperate with the establishment of God's kingdom. And then, and only then, is war permissible. So even though God told them that they would take this land, they still maintained the protocol which bespoke God's underlying purposes. He wasn't interested in conquering any land, destroying any people who were willing to allow his kingdom to be built. And there were, in an act that's strangely like the Egyptian pharaoh treating these people in the beginning of their journey, Sihon just kind of throws away his one chance of survival and comes out down to meet him, away from his fortified places in battle. That's the third tale. Fourth tale, the encounter with Og, king of Bashan. Now here there wasn't even a peace offer. This is right from the beginning, no realistic hope. Tremendous wickedness in the culture. King Og is defeated, and his territory is taken all the way up to Mount Hermon, the natural geographical barrier there. But this is a very quick summary in these few verses of chapter 3, because to Mount Hermon from Gilead to Sirion is a huge area from far north of the Dead Sea. I have my resident Israeli experts here who can confirm that, like Frida, Tony. Huge area that we're talking about, north of the Dead Sea. So what we learn from this is that in this large area they had to fight. And we can see, unfortunately, that this fourth story in the progression represented in most cases in this land. Most of the cultures were too far gone. And that's why the time was right. So I want to just go through to show you that, you see, this holy war was not indiscriminate or opportunistic killing. It was a discriminate conquest. Each people group was treated differently, whether war or peace. And in fact, you can see this, that it's really about wickedness, right? It was about and trying to establish righteousness. In the same passage, we can read of God giving lands to those who did not serve him, while denying land to a generation of Israelites who seriously disobeyed him. The holy war was conducted where sin was fulfilled. And many commentators, I don't know, they seem to get it backwards. It wasn't, because this area was not part of the promised land, there was no fighting. But because there was no fighting, this is not part of the promised land. The borders were determined by what went on when they encountered the people of the land. Now, I said before, Jesus intends to conquer, to bring his kingdom to earth. So in the time of Deuteronomy, Yahweh's intention was to conquer, to bring his kingdom to earth. That part's the same, but now something changed. Something that is different now. When we come forward into our era, into our time period, something's changed, and as usual, it has to do with the failure of the people of God in response to God. The story goes on from there, from Deuteronomy. Canaan was conquered, and God, through a painstaking process, brought together all the ingredients necessary for his kingdom. He brought together a people, a law, a land, and finally a king, the king, David. But the kingdom was not able to be sustained. They couldn't hold it. Rather than trusting God, the people turned away from God. And after a long decline, with a few heroic tales, the kingdom collapsed under its own faithlessness. They couldn't stay in the land if they couldn't represent God's kingdom. Justice, mercy, goodness, worship of Him. And so it was the final exile in 586 B.C., the time of the national theocracy on earth as a means of God's kingdom coming to earth, came to an end. It failed. And there was something that needed to be done to continue this program, and that was the king himself had to come. And because the king himself came and shed his blood, holy war no longer involved the shedding of blood. It was a priority change from focusing on the land to focusing on the righteousness in a people that would keep the land. Because it became clear that God's people would not be able to be good enough, faithful enough in the covenant to justify keeping that land. You cannot have God's kingdom on earth without God's worship, without His goodness, without His justice and mercy upheld. They couldn't do it. So Christ came to secure people's righteousness, guaranteeing their righteousness by granting them His own, which now allows the kingdom to happen in a new way. Because we see Jesus, when He comes, He stifles the impulse to take up the physical sword now in the very beginning. When Jesus was being arrested, His chief apostle took a sword to those who came to arrest Him, cut off someone's ear. And Jesus put an immediate stop to it. No, Peter, that's not the way it comes now. He didn't say He didn't intend to bring about a king. He didn't say He wasn't the king. He said it must happen in a different way, as the scripture says. So though Christ rejects the sword, He doesn't reject being the almighty king. He never denied being a king, never denied being a king, just denied being a king that works in the way of this world's king. He consistently maintained it. The kingdom was going to come and it was going to take over. No, Peter, put up your sword. No, says Paul, the weapons of our warfare are now spiritual. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. What does that mean for us? This collapse of the Old Testament theocracy. Well, from that collapse, folks, from then on, it was wrong to take up arms to spread the faith, to spread God's program. I'm saying it's always wrong to take up arms, but to take up arms to help the kingdom of heaven along is wrong. And when arms have been so taken in the last two millennia, it has been wrong. It's been counterfeit holy war. So some ruler goes to bed and has a dream of Christ saying to him, in this sign, conquer, and shows him a picture of the cross. I would greet that with a great deal of skepticism. Has this meaning. You know, and regarding this current war in Iraq, all I can say is, whatever it is, it better not be holy war. Because that's not the way that God's purposes now proceed. Well, then what is God's way? What is this new king's way of building His kingdom? By bearing witness to the holiness and love of God through your transformed lives. That's His way. It's because it's transformed lives that have the power to change other people's stony hearts. That's always the way Christianity has genuinely spread, and it will be the only way that it spreads genuinely in the future. We saw it in Ephesians, no matter where we're going through that, we saw Christ pictured from Psalm 68 as the conquering king, the returning king, bringing prisoners in our gifts to give to the church, and a gift for people. So holy war for the Christian today means taking a territory for Him through various influences, through winning people to the experience of Christ's power and love, through mastering cultural forms in order to use them to glorify Him, to bring all ideologies, left and right, captive to His feet for reinterpretation. Church building in a place where He is not known. That's conquering in God's name today. Now, this passage about taking the land then should call us to ask, what are we doing with our lives? If the Israelites' promised land, only promised land, extended to where there was enough evil to warrant conquest, then what you need to ask yourself is, where you, belonging to God, should be taking up residence and extending your efforts. In other words, as a Christian, this passage teaches us that you are called to go where the evil is. Just like they couldn't enter land, unless there was evil in us. You are called to go where it is, where darkness is, where there are problems that need the light of Christ. They only took up residence where the wickedness warranted it. So ask yourself, dear village church, is there enough evil in the place you have set as your goal to live? You don't have to answer out loud, all right? The place in which you want to settle and build your community. If not, you're not pursuing a dream fit for your station as a disciple in Christ's kingdom. We're at Holy War, still. And we're still at it. Since this text today is violent, the application to us needs to be forceful. Are you deciding where to live and build a community and how to spend your life in a way that makes a challenge to the current evil? Do you think there's evil in New York City? Well, then, folks, it qualifies as promised land. It warrants your spending your life on it. To see Christ lifted up here by making disciples here through the church. If you live in New York, you have an easy opportunity for it. But it requires a change of attitude. Now, you know, the ways we could do this is to multiply them. Meeting the scowls and anger of your neighbors with a smile. And it could just transform things. They come to you, oh, there's too much noise, there ain't too much noise. Oh, well, I am honestly concerned that you feel that way. Come upstairs. I would like to invite you to dessert. And let's discuss your grievances. Because I want to honor you if I'm going to be living with you. Because you bring your attitude to New York like that, you will transform your apartment building. What else are you doing with your life? Because do you realize how quick it goes? You know, you turn around and you're in high school. You thought it was going to take a while, but then you're there already. You turn around again, you're graduating from college. You turn around again and maybe, you know, you've got that new job that you were looking for, or you got married. Turn around again, maybe you're having your first child. And you turn around again, you're dead. Your life is a vapor. What are you doing with it? Now, I know some of you say, it's too much resistance. There's too many obstacles. It's too hard. There's certain things that I can't get around. Rent is too high. There's too much resistance in one way or another to living in this area or that area. You got to remember Og's resting place. See, those Israelites, they looked at that size of 13 feet by 6 feet, and they said, how could we move into this place? And you look at a similar square footage and say, how can we move into this apartment? In fact, I wouldn't be surprised. No. Let me hear me when I say it. Yahweh can do great things for you. He's just waiting to see if you will put your foot in the land. What's the resistance? What is it too hard? Will you turn away from God's purposes because it's just too unlikely to be possible? For shame, O descendant, O faithful descendant of Abraham. You have yet to see what God will do if you set your purposes alongside of His. If you purpose to make decisions, to strategize, make decisions, to take part in holy war, claim the earth as Christ, what resistance is really too hard? And time doesn't permit, but I'll encourage you to think of this in your work as well. Thinking of your home, but also in your work. Are you asking this question? How is this, what territory is here to be taken? That's holy war. I invite you to think about those things as we now come to the table to the one and celebrate who made this possible and who can allow us to relax in the fact that he is carrying on this war and we can jump on and be part of it. The responsibility has been taken upon him, though, to secure the righteousness to keep the Lamb. Would you stand with me now? The Lord be with you. Lift up your heart. Let us give thanks to the Lord our God. Father, it is right to give you thanks and praise because you are so tenacious, because for every opportunity and obstacle that we have presented to establishing your kingdom on earth, you continue to find a way. You continue to work your way into us, work your way into the earth, so that we could enjoy what we enjoy today, which is a resting in you having done the work for us. Lord, all the things that you have done, all the ways in which you have been patient, all the ways in which you would not, unless it was entirely right and justified, engage in things that cause difficulty and pain and even war on the earth. And because of that, and because of who you are, we join our voices with all the angels in heaven in our unending hymn of praise.